Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to today's meeting of the Capital Investment Committee. We do not have a quorum at this time, so we will save our official approval of the minutes until we do. We are hearing bills today, but for information only. We will not be taking action on any of the bills that we're hearing today. We're starting out today with a bunch of Norwegians. It seems like they've been... wait a minute. Now, we do not allow props in our committee, so no signs and certainly no flags. We run a tight ship here. Now, the testifiers table, that's okay. They can do what they want. But to those of you in the audience, please maintain your decorum. We have high expectations. I have to tell everyone here that most of my heritage is Swedish, and so I am hearing this with some trepidation. I have to tell you also that I grew up in a country where the North Fork of the Watonwan River that runs through my farm was the dividing line between the Swedes on the south and the Norwegians on the north, and no one dared cross that line, especially to go a courting, for a couple of generations at least. However, now we're in the enlightened era where people cross freely over the river and court whoever they care to. However, there's another little story that 4 years ago when they redistricted my area, if I had stayed on my farm and run from there, I would have had to run against a fellow Republican. So my wife and I made the decision to buy a home in what was mostly my old district in Brown County. So I now have an official residence address, and the city is Hanska. Hanska is probably the most Norwegian little town in the whole darn state. And they, in fact, they are so Norwegian, they have a sit into my parade coming up in May. So I feel like I'm kind of the Swedish ambassador to the Norwegian part of Brown County. Anyway, with that frivolous stuff out of the way, we'll get to the serious work here. We do have a quorum. I will officially call the meeting to order. Representative Atkins, would you care to move the minutes of April 12th? Representative Atkins moves the minutes. Any discussion?
Yeah.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And opposed by the same sign, the minutes are approved. We do have a special guest with us today. I see the governor has come. I saw him outside the building a little earlier. I asked him if he drove or if he rode his horse today. apparently he did drive. So welcome. Well, Representative Clark, it's your bill. We'll let you have the opening remarks.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, yes, we are honored to have the presence of our former governor here, and I have to say, just reminiscing with him, that I got to serve during a couple of years of his administration, so it's a while back. So I am honored to bring before you the bill for the Norway House funding, and this bill is really a wonderful opportunity for us to build, actually we're going to pre-design, design, construct, furnish, and equip a conference and event center on Franklin Avenue, which is in my district. And this is a place where Norway House will be expanding and creating a wonderful place that really serves as a bridge to the community with the Norwegian community. I have to say, you know, my district has been the home for new Americans for generations, long before even I have represented it, which is a fairly long time. And so over the years, this has been a hospitable area for immigrants, new Americans to come. And I love the fact that across from this facility that exists now and the expansion, we have people of all different cultures, East African, American Indian, and so on. And there's lots of communication back and forth. So this event center will really provide that kind of bridge for Norwegian Americans to not only have a national center, and you'll hear more about that in a moment, but also one that really connects the community, and that's really important to all of us. It's a bridge between Americans and not only contemporary Norway, but also the people who live in South Minneapolis. I'm going to let the governor and so on speak, but I do want to just say one thing. We have here some wonderful sharings from the community, some food, some delicious examples of what Norwegian culture produces. And I want to particularly thank my legislative assistant, Amanda Rudolph, who has made the lefse that you are all going to be...
excuse me, Representative Clark. Treats start here. These have to be approved. These have to be approved by the chair. They look like they're okay, so it's okay then to pass them around to the rest of the committee.
If I could just ask Amanda, who made these, handmade these. This is part of her cultural heritage. Amanda, will you just set up so we can thank you?
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you very much. We don't have a lot of rules in the Capital Investment Committee. We do have some.
Okay.
Go ahead, Representative Clark.
So
I'm
again,
sorry to interrupt you.
Again, this is to create a wonderful Senate. I'm going to let the governor talk with some more about that. He's been one of the big champions for this particular facility, and it's really going to be wonderful. So, Governor Quay.
Thank you, Representative Clark. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Al Quay. And I used to have an office over here, but they got construction stuff all over.
Yeah. Welcome to our committee, Governor. We're glad to have you here today.
My first thought, I have to tell you, is the same thing as some of you might have thought. And that is, why should the taxpayers pay for something to honor Norwegians? And this isn't to honor Norwegians. This is to help people of Minnesota understand a little bit of what's happened in this country and in this state. Before this building is built, there's been the Mindekirken Church for a long time. And none of you would go there. Because you wouldn't understand the language. Yeah. Yeah. So, the Norway House has been built right here. And then this whole new facility that's being made available. This is something that will draw people to this area. It will honor people who come here before. And when my folks would take me up to Minneapolis, and I'd visit with two aunts, and they talked about their parents and grandparents coming to this country and settling first in Wisconsin, and I hope nobody in the press writes about this, but they were typical Norwegians. They bought some land in the wintertime when they came, and it turned out to be swampland. So they came here, and then my father's siblings, some of them were up here. Now, one of the things, because we believe in the equality of the gender, my aunt that I visited, Emma Bonas, graduated from St. Olaf College in 1898. You see how far ahead of us some people could be. And so when you have something of this nature, then everybody can join in and help them understand this, but they might look deeper into their own ancestry and help them in that way as well. Because every time you get to know somebody better, it enhances your own understanding of your own person. Now, I hope you'll let me just tell you one quick story. When I ran for the state senate in 1954, I had in my district Lonsdale, Czechoslovakian people called the Bohemians. I didn't know any of them, but a couple of them wanted me to be their state senator for some reason or other, and they invited me there, and they invited me to go to their church, a Catholic church. And it was wonderful to do it. And afterwards they said, now stand here, and you can shake hands with people who have come out. I felt uneasy about that. But afterwards a priest bawled me out for doing this. A few years later, I went to a threshing bee to remember the old threshing way they used to do up by Lonsdale. and that priest was back again for a vacation. And he came up and apologized to me for what he had said outside of his church. Now, you tell that, you get uncomfortable. But my warm feelings for Lonsdale, the people there, and that priest, is just wonderful. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, that's all different from the Norwegian stuff I came back for. So I think this is worth the bonding to help build this building, because it will reward people so much. It will reward people in Minneapolis so much that it'll be worth it to go there and spend time with it and understanding it. Beside that, they sell Ole and Lena jokes there.
Well, thank you, Governor. We're honored to have you in our committee today. Thank you for making the trek to come to the Capitol. And do we have other testifiers?
Representative Albrecht.
I'd have to welcome you to the committee. You belong there. So go ahead, Representative Albrecht.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And it is, as Governor Quay said, it is about belonging. And I will hark back to the mid-1800s when the immigration from the homeland really started in earnest. And a couple of particulars that you might be compelled by. Minneapolis actually has the largest contingent of Norwegians outside of Norway itself. So when you ponder that thought in and of itself, it's pretty important. But alongside that, I think you might also remark the contribution, both financially, economically, and otherwise, to the state of Minnesota by those immigrants. I don't think that can be lost on anyone, and I believe that you might have something in your packet pertinent to that as well. I think Governor Quay said it well. What we're looking for is to settle, to find a place where not only those that know the story can go, but also for the younger generations can go as well, hear about their ancestry, and connect with those who lived it firsthand. And so from that standpoint, it is a meeting place. It is a calm harbor, if you will, to use a metaphor, for folks of all immigrant nations to come together, but in particular here, for those of Norwegian ancestry to be able to tell their story and to pay it forward for those that are coming after them. I will, with that, also remark there's a story about an individual who made this journey back in 1921. At the ripe old age of 17, he was told by his father and his mother that there was no longer room for him to be housed in on the home place. Mm-hmm. And so with that, he was given enough money to take steerage to Brooklyn, New York. Mm-hmm. And from there, he made his way to Ames, Iowa, and then subsequently to Freeborn County. You have a picture of that gentleman in your packet. That gentleman is my grandfather. But in so saying, we all have a story like that in our past. And it is about finding place. It is about finding who you are based upon who came before you. And in as much as that's important, it is also important that we remark on future generations in terms of our ancestry, about what makeup we are. It's in our DNA. And it's in every person. And so with that, I'm happy to respond to any questions asked of me by the committee, or we do have some individuals from Norway House here as well. We thank you for the opportunity to share our story with you, and look forward to responding to questions. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Was that your great-grandfather that came here through Iowa?
No, that was my grandfather.
Your grandfather, so he was probably not.
He was 17.
He was probably not the original Iowegian then.
I would share this with the committee that he didn't stay long in Iowa. He found living much better in Freeborn County. I will note that the first interesting factoid. The first settlement for Norwegians was in Houston County, Spring Grove.
Didn't know that.
Subsequent to that, they also immigrated to Fillmore, and then over the course of the many decades coming after, they actually have taken up residency all over the state of Minnesota.
Excellent. Thank you. I believe we have other testifiers. Is that
correct? Two witnesses, Mr. Chairman, yes. I'd like to ask John Peterson.
Please take
us. Do I need to speak into a microphone?
Yes, you do. This is for the benefit of posterity, Mr. Peterson. We want to make sure we have your fine voice on tape. So please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Yeah, hey, the young Peterson, or I come from Spicer, Minnesota. And it's been mentioned as far as we have a campus there that we're establishing with the Norske Lutherske Minnekirke, the only church on this continent where the church services are still delivered in Norwegian every Sunday. But more importantly for this project is we intend to establish the base and the connection between Norway, modern Norway, and ourselves here in Minnesota. And 2.5 million Norwegian Americans within a 300-mile radius of Minneapolis, and we will be a national center, and the Norwegians want to see this happen too. And with that, I want to introduce the vice consul from the Norwegian consulate, Christina Johansen Carlton.
Thank you. Welcome to committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Christina Carlton with the Norwegian Consulate. As an official representative of the Norwegian government here in Minnesota, I'm representing the Royal Norwegian Honorary Consulate General, and as a resident, a long-standing resident of Minnesota, we support Norway House, and we support this bill, and we're just thrilled that this is happening here in Minnesota.
Thank you, Christina. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Rebecca Jorgensen-Sundquist with Norway House. I think on page 113 of Earl Bakken's biography, he gives credit to his success, and we all know that he was the great founder of Medtronic, to being Norwegian and being Lutheran. I think you have two great qualities in that gentleman that describe how the Norwegian immigrants have imprinted and impacted the state of Minnesota. We take clean government for granted. We take care for the environment for granted. It's part of our DNA. This is what our ancestors have brought to Norway, from Norway to the United States. This project is important to us. You might say, why is it important, Rebecca? It's about identity. If we don't know who we are and where we've come from and what our families have stood for, we don't know where we're going. And our state, like the rest of the United States, is changing. I want to do a shout-out to my friend Robeson. Robeson is from Ethiopia. When he came 6 years ago, he was an intern here at the state capitol. Some of you might recognize him. He offices at Norway House. He runs an international interpreting business. This is what's possible. This is what's possible when we encourage and welcome different nationalities. And as Representative Clark said, her neighborhood, or the neighborhood of Norway House, is a melting pot. We're committed to being on the Franklin Avenue between Elliott and 10th Avenue location. This is an immigrant neighborhood. This is where our ancestors started, and this is where we're going to welcome new ancestors, and we're creating partnerships. It's a neighborhood in transition. We think that's important for you to know, and we think it'll be transformational. Having a new Norway House there, having a $15 million investment in that community is going to be transformational. Some of you have been over to see Norway House. We invite the rest of you to come over and tour. We anticipate that there will be more and more robust programming, because when you have space, you can carry out mission. We're here to ask for your support. We have a $5 million cash request. It's important. We need your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sundquist. I believe we've exhausted the list of testifiers. Do members have questions? Representative Erdahl,
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and testifiers. Are we sure that just Norway House is enough? We mean like Norway Village, Norway City. I mean, to really appreciate the Norwegian culture of the state of Minnesota, which, of course, once was dominant, but now, over the years, has declined a little bit, I certainly think that this is a good idea. It could be even bigger.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Erdahl. I did not hear a question. Representative Hausman.
Mr. Chair, the last testifier actually just underscored what I thought we needed to observe, and that is because this is a nonprofit, it is not eligible for GO bonding, but would have to be cash, and that was the last comment, I think, that you...
Thank you for pointing that out, Representative Hausman. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wondered if you could comment on any non-state funds that are applied to the project.
Ms. Sun.
The funds will be matched. I'm going to ask for
expert here to talk. We have raised up to $4.2 million. We have purchased the Wings Financial Building and remodeled it, so it's currently operating as the Norway House Education Center. So phase two is what we're seeking funding for, and if you come closer, you can see the model, but we're working on raising funds for the event center. The event center will be about an 18,000-square-foot building. It'll have event space, banquet space for about 400, a restaurant, large pre-function area, meeting rooms, offices, and then there will be a plaza that will connect all components. We have purchased the additional property needed for the whole project, so we now have the whole city block locked up. It'll be known as the National Norwegian Center in America. It will be the only national center dedicated totally and wholly to Norwegians in the United States. And where better to do it but here in the Minneapolis area? Did you know there are more Norwegians in Minneapolis than there are in Oslo, Norway? I mean, that's the demographics. That's how a big of an imprint this culture has on the state of Minnesota. But I hope that you'll gather to see the model. It's designed by architect Dewey Thorbeck. Dewey designed the Minnesota Zoo. He's designed the Bell Museum. It's a LEED certified green building. We're dedicated to energy efficiency, just as Norwegians are. The structural glass that you see for the pre-function area is wavy. It's what they're using in the new stadium, the new U.S. Bank Stadium. So it will be quite an impact and imprint in the neighborhood.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative? I don't see one. No. Representative Lily Oden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representatives, for bringing this forward. And Governor Klee, I'm probably one of the few people that read your book on riding across the country. It was I happen to know the lady that you worked with, Carol Pettit. It was much better written than Representative Erdahl's books.
Might I briefly comment, Mr. Chair? That,
yes, Representative Erdahl, you have a chance to defend.
Just real quick, you don't compliment an author by saying, I'm one of the few people who read your book.
I suppose that's true. It was a very good book. It was sounds like quite an adventure, but thank you for bringing this forward. I think it's a great idea. I'm one of those people that I'm surrounded by some of those Swedes, and I'm getting sick of going to the Swedish Institute for lunch and tours, so maybe you guys will have to come to our Norwegia house or village, if you will. And I hope you have a story of the people that did have come to Minnesota, like Representative Albright's, because I remember the story of my family in Wayland, and they had a store in town there with lutefisk out on the porch, dried lutefisk that people could buy, right? Wayland, Minnesota, they had for years. But thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. I believe we are ready for some closing remarks, whoever would like. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Dean, I missed your question.
That's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is more of a comment, I guess, and a question. I want to thank you, Representative Erdahl, for reminding us about the immigrant story. We all, if we go back in our past, we do have an immigrant story. And we also have current immigrants, and we can't forget about their stories as well.
Thank you, Representative Dean. I see no one else on the list. Closing remarks, whoever would care to give them.
I'll just say, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate this information and hearing, and I hope that the committee will decide to vote positively on this. It is quite an incredible resource that's being proposed here today. And I love the comments that have been made about understanding the connections between all of our New Americans and our ancestors and how we can come together in a place like this. It'll be a remarkable facility.
Thank you, Representative Clark. Governor Cree, would you care to make some remarks?
Let me just add one thing here that I mentioned to Africans who have come to the United States. All the anthropologists say that the human race began in Africa. And so I look at this as these new people come to Minnesota, will they be able to build a relationship with us? They could come and visit a place both here and the Swedish Institute where people went the farthest north and then came here, lived amongst the icebergs long enough we got pale. And we all are carrying that complexion now. But I say this so you can weave that into it, because when I talk to Africans and African Americans and say this, their whole body changes because they know they're being respected. And this is going to help in our so much of a broader aspect that I think is worth state funding for the $5 million.
Well, thank you, Governor. Thank you for those remarks. Thank you for being here. Thanks to all of you for being here today. We appreciate your enthusiasm, and we will move on to the next topic. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Maybe we'll just take a little share of Alexa since it missed this table.
Next up, we have the Department of Administration. We're going to talk about a request for capital security issues.
I know what left.
My dad was full of it. I think they think
of little
how much
do I have to
well.
All right, we'll get back to our meeting. Commissioner Masman, welcome to committee. You have a tough act to follow today. I hope you brought some good treats for us.
Welcome in, Mr. Chairman. I think that's all I have. I'm a product of Houston County, so I've spent a lot of time going through Spring Grove, and they tried to educate me as best possible.
Well,
I was good Norwegian, but that's the only thing that stuck with me.
That's good to know. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Mr. Chairman and members, Commissioner Mossman, Department of Administration. With me is Chris Given, the Director of Plant Management, and thank you for the opportunity. And I do want to start off by saying it is a great pleasure to follow former Governor Cui. It's always a delight to hear him talk, and that was a really neat story. So, Mr. Chairman and members, I appreciate the opportunity to present Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith's bonding recommendations related to Capitol Complex security and walk through and answer any questions that you have on that proposal today. The first slide here, just even as our presentation this morning is primarily about the physical security improvements that are proposed as part of the bonding recommendations, which is a total of $26.6 million, including $7.7 million in general fund request and $18.5 million in general obligation bond request. I do want to just note that the governor has laid out some key principles for his overall budget recommendations and his bonding recommendations. And some of those key guiding principles are making sure that the state maintains a fiscally responsible budget and that we protect Minnesota's financial future. And I want to call attention to that nothing is more important to doing that than also being mindful of our physical assets and our data assets and the other work that we as fiduciary agents on behalf of the people of Minnesota are responsible for protecting. And I think that that speaks really to a lot of the recommendations that the Department of Administration has before you in total, the $38.3 million in general obligation for various state facilities and specifically for the Capitol Complex security recommendations as well. Both protecting state assets, and it's also, I think, a fiscally sensible time to be borrowing money and be investing in these assets. So if you would, Mr. Chairman, if we go on to the, we're actually going to skip to slide five first, and I just want to give you some background. The Advisory Committee on capital area security was created in 2012 statutorily by the legislature. The purpose of the committee is to assess and advise the legislature on security issues and recommend improvements as necessary. The committee is chaired by the Lieutenant Governor. The membership is composed of the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, members of both houses of the legislature from each political party. It also consists of advisors from the legislative, judicial, executive branches of state government, as well as those of corporate and educational sectors in our community. One of the first undertakings of the committee was to hire a consultant to conduct a physical security study to determine the vulnerability of Capitol Complex against threats. Previous studies had been done and had focused on operational security vulnerabilities. This one specifically focused on physical vulnerabilities of the building. The study was led by architects, engineers, security professionals. It focused on structural landform and architectural elements of the structures in the state capitol complex. It assigned a security risk levels and priorities, and it provided a roadmap, so to speak, for the physical security improvements on the complex. That study was completed in 2014. The study identified, I wanted to give you that in the way of background, as this is, these recommendations are before you as part of the Governor and Lieutenant Governor's bonding recommendations. They were also a proposal and recommendations made by that bipartisan committee. The study identified vulnerabilities across the Capitol complex. It assigned, as I said, mentioned a risk level to each building and a priority for each building vulnerability. The risks were based on the potential loss of life, assets, impacts to government operations. The priority was based on the urgency of the need to eliminate the vulnerability. To reduce the vulnerabilities, the study recommended the following type of security upgrades across the Capitol complex. And as I go through the list, I would also just point out that we'll be doing our very best, both in the presentation today and in whatever questions, responding to whatever questions you may have, that the details of the security study itself and the specifics of the vulnerabilities were non-public information given the notion that we believe that there's a fair amount of background information, then we believe we can answer your questions here today.
Commissioner, if I could interrupt for just a moment. When you say Capitol Complex, just how large a scope are we talking about?
Mr. Chair and members, good question. So two things on that. The Capitol Complex is the Department of Administration custodially owns and manages Chris and his team.
23.
Yeah, 23 facilities on the Capitol complex, which essentially takes in into the edge of downtown St. Paul with the Anderson Building and then the Freeman Buildings, Department of Revenue, Stassen Building, certainly the Capitol Building itself, Department of Transportation, so everything up here around the mall. It also includes the Historical Society, as an example, and includes the Minnesota Retirement Systems Building a few blocks away, as well as a few just plant buildings that are also in the area just to the east of, down the hill to the east of the Judicial Building, and so on and so forth. I think that captures, in essence, the area. And the second thing I would point out is, just to be clear as we go along, this recommendation and ask is not for the Capitol Building itself and the Capitol Mall or Plaza. There were, as you many of you may recall, was some resources included in the bonding bill last year that are part of that project, and that work is actually going on right now as part of the restoration effort and the exterior work that's going on in that building. So, Mr. Chair and members, there are similarities, however, with some of that work and the physical improvements. Without actually identifying the vulnerabilities themselves, some of the work that would be done as a result of this recommendation and these resources would be to install bollards, which are posts or objects that stop vehicles from approaching buildings. It would be used for the installation of projectile-resistant glass in select locations of the buildings. Installation of additional card readers to secure non-public areas of buildings, construction of security kiosks in facilities that do not already have them, incorporation of utility protection features to guard against exposed utilities and power sources, installation of entry controls on parking facilities adjacent to buildings, installation of additional emergency call stations throughout the complex, securing our vulnerable building air intakes to limit exposure to hazardous materials and explosives, and similarly providing window well protection to those windows on the complex that are below grade. So those are some examples of the work that would be done with these resources. I should just for background, there's different types. We did, I glossed over it on, if we go back and you can read this for yourself, I would just say I glossed over this slide and we won't talk a lot about it in detail, but there's different, when the professionals come in and look at this, there's different types of security risks and threats that they look at. They fall into three or four different categories, and then based on examples from other either U.S. or world experiences that they use to then assess the buildings. So, Mr. Chair and members, the funding then recommended, and I would, in the way of background, I also want to point out, I commented earlier on the bigger picture, just to add a little bit more detail to the importance, and it speaks to some other elements that are in the governor's recommendations elsewhere in the bonding bill, but as you know, the Department of Administration also has a role to play broadly in asset preservation and maintaining a centralized database for having an apples-to-apples comparison of state facilities across the state generally. And I do want to call attention to work that and information that comes out of that. We have about $1.3 billion in deferred maintenance in the state of Minnesota right now with roughly over 5,000 buildings across agencies that state government owns. And one of the pieces that I would leave you with of information that I think is most telling about the relevance of that information is just that we can tell from that data that there is a substantial difference in the cost impacts of maintaining buildings when they are in their still in their relatively good state compared to when they fall into a crisis or critical state. It costs about $289 is the deferred maintenance per square foot on a building that is in crisis condition compared to about $60 a square foot to bring up to snuff a building that is in good condition. So I put that in the way of context for all of this ask. This is one piece of many various asset preservation asks that are part of the governor's bonding recommendations. In sum, the piece, the recommendation specifically to Capital Complex physical security totals $26.2 million from the two sources, $18.5 million of bonding funds would pay for upgrades to buildings that were originally constructed with general obligation bonds. The distinction is then that the other $7.7 million in cash would be needed for buildings that were not originally constructed with general obligation bonds are not eligible for general obligation funded improvements. So those would be the Department of Transportation building, the Anderson building, the Freeman building, and the Minnesota State Retirement Systems building. So with that, Mr. Chairman and members, I urge you, and happy to answer any questions, but urge you to implement the recommendations in the study and help us provide some practical solutions and improvements to reduce the vulnerabilities to our physical buildings in the Capitol Complex.
Thank you, Commissioner Rifson. Wagenius has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let's go back to the number. I'm not sure I heard your second number when you talked about a building that's in good shape and you're just upkeeping it versus a building that is on the downside and you're having to restore it. You gave us two numbers, and would you just repeat those?
Commissioner Masman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, the numbers I gave were $58 a square foot for a building that's in good condition compared to $289 a square foot for a building that's in crisis condition.
Representative Wagenius.
Do we, in the proposals you're making, do you have any, is this mostly $58 a square foot we're working on, or is it $289, or what's the range here?
Commissioner Madden.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, those numbers don't specifically tie to this proposal so much as I just wanted to provide those in the way of an overall context, and mind you, deferred maintenance is different from asset preservation. Asset preservation takes into account programmatic changes and priorities that are important and what the future use of the buildings will be in terms of what the investment should be. But to put in context the importance of supporting recommendations like this and other asset preservation recommendations in order to support and maintain the state's facilities.
Thank you. Representative Hausman, did you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Really, just comments on two sections. One, for members, since his first slide showed all of the budget recommendations, I've had the conversation with him. But as a St. Paul taxpayer, when their plan is to buy two lots on University Avenue and convert them to surface parking, on University Avenue, the Green Line, where we want, of course, commercial business and lots of economic activity, and so I'm, of course, strongly opposed to for the state to buy two lots for surface parking on University Avenue. The further comment about that, and I don't know who deals with this if they don't, we have so many vacant parking spaces. I mean, I just know State Office Building where I drive in every day, and I think we have to figure out how do we cooperate with them to use every parking space that is already built. There are many empty spaces in the State Office Building. I don't know if that's true of others. But the other, to your physical security, so help me understand, after we have spent $26.2 million, because I believe in state law, we have made possible anyone can do concealed carry anywhere on this campus, and they don't have to get permits from any Capitol security people, and a disgruntled taxpayer wouldn't be recognized as a criminal actor, how, after $26.2 million, is there any security with that in our law?
Commissioner Masman?
Mr. Chair and Representative, this, I think the issue you're raising is something that probably was the topic of a lot of conversation as part of the committee, the bipartisan committee that made these recommendations. So there's no guarantee in any of this, and I doubt that any professional security expert would make such a claim. It really is a question of do we take steps or not take steps to manage and mitigate risks where we can, and reduce and diminish the exposure and the potential scope of something that could happen or befall. But of course, there's no guarantees, and there's no foolproof system with regard to that. And so there is relevance to considering other laws and impacts and how those might relate to this responsibility. But again, this ask, I think, from a principal standpoint, is really born out of the same sort of philosophy that any major employer or player in the state of Minnesota might be asking, and that is, what are we doing to, as a state, as our fiduciary responsibility on the part of state assets and the responsibility to protect and manage space for state employees, doing what we can to live up to that responsibility.
Thank you, Commissioner. Could you backtrack to the first part of Representative Hausman's remarks regarding surface lots and parking, and perhaps address a topic that I've been thinking about a little bit and we've chatted about a little bit? That would be the Ford building.
Mr. Chair and members, I can't say that. I'd be delighted to do so. But so, okay, absolutely. So a couple things. I certainly encourage you, and I understand where Representative Hausman, you and I have talked about this several times, is coming from. I do urge support for that governor's recommendation. The first thing I would say is we are working with all of the parking facilities. Well, first of all, we're doing all that we can to promote use of the Green Line and transit. That's always been part of our parking business operations. We subsidize a public transit because it does, from a cost comparison standpoint, it certainly is more cost effective to subsidize use of transit than it is to build parking spaces of any kind. So that is one a key priority of our work. We also, a lot of times what happens is the location of our parking facilities is not necessarily where people are working. So we have supply and demand issues. We also have location issues. And so we are doing everything we can to make sure we're identifying vacant spaces. And I think there are some spaces that have been in transition with the Capitol complex and certainly the opening of the new building and tenants moving around that has resulted in some underutilized parking facilities. And I agree, it would be my preference and priority as commissioner to make sure that we're fully utilizing all of those parking spaces. That said, I think that there is advantages in both owning and controlling some key properties that are adjacent to and closely related to a state property that may be of use for something other than parking facilities by the state of Minnesota in the future. With regard to the Ford building is certainly the proverbial a situation in search of a solution. So we pay about $45,000 a year to maintain the building and just keep it standing. It's on the critical list. So it's one of those buildings that falls into this category of $1.3 billion in deferred maintenance, for example. So it certainly is a facility that at some point, I would urge us to figure out a way together to move forward on either replacing that building, restoring it, or maintaining it in part, perhaps keeping its facade and doing something with the rest of the building. But it is a long-term perspective, it's certainly not, I don't think, financially sensible to continue to forever just pay to maintain a building for safety reasons without doing something with it. But I hope that answers your question. It's about $1.6 million is our current estimate to demolish the building. It would be, we think, cost prohibitive to restore the building. It's quite expensive to restore. It's not in great condition.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Commissioner. I just want to make sure that topic is planted in people's minds. Along those same lines, could you review the current situation on the Centennial Ramp?
So the situation on the Centennial Ramp, and Mr. Given will jump in and make sure that I have the details correct. We, as many of you know, we had to last fall completely, we were doing an annual routine review of physical review of that building and discovered that on one level, all of the building, it was built in the late 60s, all of the ramp, and it's the largest, most centrally located ramp in the state government complex here. It's about 1,400 parking stalls. So it's from top to bottom, it's an overall need of a restoration to improve it for the next 40, 50 years and maintain that asset. But what we discovered during the annual review was that while there was work needed to the whole building on one level, there were actually post-tension cables that were either broken, snapped, so there was a legitimate risk, immediate risk and safety concern with one level of the ramp. And so we immediately shut down that level of the ramp, shorted up from underneath. If you were to see it from underneath, it basically has steel beams that are supporting it all the way underneath. We immediately moved to allocate limited resources that we had available to start the emergency repairs. We've completed about half of those. So we've reopened about half of the stalls on the level that was completely closed, and at this point we're in need of additional resources to both bring to complete that emergency work so that we can bring all of the stalls in that facility back online, as well as to complete the work to the rest of the building.
Thank you. And approximately how many spaces are unusable at this time in the Centennial Ramp?
About 200.
Thank you. Representative Hausman?
To that point, you and I have also talked about the fact that they've got a park on the top, and we thought it was time to challenge that historic designation. There's got to be some way around that. Somehow, I think having to maintain a park up there that no one uses has been part of the degradation of the integrity of the ramp, too.
Thank you, Representative Hausman. Of course, that is also a somewhat controversial subject, as those of us that know our history, there was a park there, Central Park, that was displaced by the ramp, and the agreement at the time was that they would maintain a park on top of the ramp. I've been up on top of that ramp and seen that park. I don't think it's overused. Any other questions for the Representative Volk?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious on the renovation and the way there might be, if there's a review process. And the reason I bring that up is that we're looking at big numbers, and we're approaching $300 a square foot for a renovation of a building, which you can probably build a new building for. And I realize that there's certain things that we want to retain, but curious what type of a review process the state uses to make sure that we're getting the best maybe bang for the buck. In other words, because there's walnut on the walls here, maybe we don't redo walnut or something, recognizing that there's certain historic features, but by the same token, what type of review process is there for kind of a example like in a private sector where everybody's trying to squeeze a penny?
Commissioner Masman.
I'm going to, Mr. Chair and Representative, I would just say generally that I think we find ourselves squeezing the penny on almost every project that we do. But I'm going to ask Mr. Given to just talk about the pre-design process a little bit and what we go through on all capital projects.
Thank you. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Mr. Chair, my name is Christopher Given. I am the Director of Plant Management. We manage the facilities on the Capitol Complex. And it's my understanding the question is about the Capitol restoration, or?
No, it's just about generally.
Oh, general restoration. Well, there are several steps. I mean, when we look at a building, we look at several factors before we decide to put money into a building. We look at what its useful life will be moving forward. We look at the cost of land, other things that it would take to build a completely new facility. And after we make the decision to move forward, we undergo a pre-design process, which kind of confirms our initial decisions, where we hire architects, retain architects and engineers to take a look at the buildings, to actually identify how much it would cost to bring the building up to current codes and standards. And there's a vetting process that goes through, you know, looking at both the building codes, environmental codes, and the need standards of today's workers. And, you know, from that, we flush that out. You look at, you know, whether or not the building is on historical register, whether or not, you know, it's, again, still using serving a useful purpose on the Capitol Complex. And so it's quite a drawn-out process. It usually takes 6 months to a year to go through this with several professionals that help us make those decisions of whether or not to continue on with using that facility and bringing it up to today's codes and standards.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, the other thing that I would just add is kind of to the principle and the concept. You know, I can assure you that if you walk through state buildings, you would not find anything in the way of extravagance in terms of the building materials and what the construction process and what they look like. And, you know, I would just say, especially as an employer that needs to compete like all other employers for the best and brightest talent, I occasionally go meet with colleagues and professional contacts, as many of you do, I'm sure, in private sector buildings, and there's no expectation that our buildings should look like all of those, but we actually do compete with those firms oftentimes for the best and brightest talent. And I think, you know, as Commissioner of Administration, I would just say that I think it's important going forward, especially as we have a bubble of state employees that will soon be retiring and will need to be competing for them, that we be thoughtful and sensible about how we can make sure our work environments are productive and attractive and help us recruit and retain employees. And so I think that you know, the question has relevance in that regard also.
Thank you. A follow-up, Representative Vogel?
Ms. Chair, yeah, just one. And it wasn't meant to be derogatory toward the process that you're using. I guess life has changed for everybody since, especially the recession, especially in the business world. And I've just noticed there's so much more scrutiny on things. And, you know, even in our little business, we have an outside board of directors that will keep track of me and say, are you making sure you're doing this? And that's why I was wondering if there's some outside review process or whatever that's either in place or maybe being considered. And I don't want to drag on the conversation, but, you know, if we could cut 10% off of $1.3 billion, we had $130 million, we could do a lot. And just again, I don't want to drag on the conversation, but just a suggestion to look and see if there's any way to cut down this cost per square foot a little bit, just because on big numbers a little bit helps. So,
Mr. Given, did you have a response? Or,
well, Mr. Given was reminding me that there's an outside board that helps select designers. So there's a state designer selection board for that is appointed with outside members to help select that part of the professional staff that supports projects. But it's a point well taken, and I think, you know, we certainly need to and are doing all we can to make sure that we're making the dollars go as far as possible, because it's much better to keep and maintain buildings on the front end than it is to have emergency boiler situations and roofs collapse and that sort of thing. And frankly, that's part of the Department of Administration's ask also, as we have something called the CAPRA fund that we use to fund those emergency repairs when they come up across state government. And we tend to be getting more of them as deferred maintenance increases. So.
Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll has the last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is just really pinging off of what Representative Vogel started. Commissioner, we have a lot of your area and other agencies that come forward asking for capital requests. Is there an organized effort to try to create economies of scale? And an implementation this year will undertake this variety of repairs or this variety of activities so that all state assets, whether they happen to be Minsky or others, and I realize we're crossing some boundaries, but if we're going to be doing parking lot restorations, that we've put together all of the parking lot restorations and try to work with a contractor to get the best pricing that we can and just take advantage of those economies of scale in a 3 or 5 or 7 year plan so that we can make those dollars and pennies go a little bit further.
Commissioner Masson.
Hey, Mr. Chairman and Representative O'Driscoll, that's a really good point. I think that there's a lot of different lenses for the economies of scale in construction. I mean, one lens is not just kind of the types of work, like parking facilities, because sometimes that may be an economy of scale, but it might not be if some of the facilities are here in Minneapolis and St. Paul and some of them are in Duluth or St. Peter or St. Cloud. They're going to probably end up being different construction companies, and so sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. Certainly, if we're going to, for example, do some major work on a building, we would want to look. We would want to look at. Well, if we're going to be replacing, you know, part of the security hospital at St. Peter, what else do we need to do while we're doing that, so that we don't have to redo something, you know, later on, 5 years later. So I think there's many different ways to look at economies of scale and making sure we're sequencing projects, and we definitely do as much of that as we can.
Thank you, Commissioner. With that, we're going to close off this conversation. I know you're available when needed. Thank you for being with us today. Thanks to both of you. We have three more bills to go through this afternoon, members, so we'll have a little shy of 15 minutes for each. Bill Representative Hansen, you're up next. Welcome to the testifiers table. Representative Hansen, go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I believe we're bringing up testifiers for House File 2518. And I don't know if the committee knows, but we have two small towns in the heart of the metro area, Mendota and Lilydale. So this isn't all of Lilydale. This is the elected officials and the city manager with Lilydale. And they are here to talk about a small project in a small town in the heart of the metro area, where we're looking for a little money for a little town in the heart of the metro area. And I think you're going to see, because everybody's here to show their support for this little project for a little town in the heart of the metro area. So I have the mayor here and a variety of councilors, and I'm going to back away and let them talk about how this project is and what dollars are coming together. So.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead.
My name is Anita Pampush. I am the mayor of Lilydale. And as Representative Hansen has remarked, we are a relatively small city. We're located just across the 35E bridge from St. Paul in northern Dakota County. Our city is built on two bluffs and has lovely views of the river, so we are it's some of the most desirable parts of our city is our location. On the other hand, those very bluffs and other things that are happening there are the things that give us on the city council, who are responsible for the infrastructure of the city, some of our biggest headaches. So we've been working in various ways to try to improve, especially stormwater management and so on, for the citizens of Lilydale. We are of a small population. I guess the number is somewhere in the 900s, so we've grown a whole lot because it was only in the 600s a couple of years ago. We also operate with a very small budget. Our city budget is about $550,000 a year. A couple of years ago, when we knew we were about to have a big road project, the work that was being done on Highway 13, which runs right through the middle of the city. We set aside some money in reserve because we knew the city was going to have to make its contribution. We managed to put together some money for our reserves, but we basically spent them on the road project. However, the road project also gave us the idea that we could enhance some of the stormwater management and so on for our own citizens. And so we have designed a project which will enlarge one of the pipes that will carry the water under the residential properties and down under the bluff into the Mississippi River. And we call this the drop shaft project. And that's what we have come to talk to you about today. We are interested, and we have done enough of this planning that we have bids on that project. We don't have the cash. We're looking to find money to fund our project because we believe it would be a benefit to everyone in the city, but also to the neighbors and to all others who are concerned about the quality of water and the way it's managed in cities that live on bluffs. So that's the overview. And I have my colleague Bob Bullard here, who is really our water expert, and he's going to give you the details of the project.
Thank you. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Bob Bullard. I'm a city councilman for the city of Lilydale, and I had a kind of a hands-on experience with this project since it started. The specific part of the project that we're asking for help from the state is the drop shaft structure, which has yet to be built. It is the final phase of the upgrading of the stormwater system for the city. The larger project started about 3.5 years ago when the Minnesota Department of Transportation informed us of the plans to upgrade and resurface Highway 13, otherwise known as Sibley Memorial Highway, which is Lilydale's main street, if you will. Matter of fact, our only street. We have 500 feet of Victoria Avenue that we take care of, but that hardly counts. But anyway, that was very welcome news to us, obviously, and presented a unique opportunity at that time for upgrading the stormwater disposal system of the city. Being a bluff city and downstream, if you will, from every other city that surrounds us, we're the last means of discharge of stormwater over the bluff to the Mississippi River, and we also have subterranean water flow, which a lot of people don't realize. But if you ever walk the Big Rivers Regional Trail down there, you'll see a lot of outflow coming from that area as well. That's due to the fact that the substrate of rock under that under all of Lilydale and most of the bluff is a mixture of stratified limestone, sandstone, and shale, which over the time erodes in different quantities and times and creates underground streams. The project that we needed to address was the fact that a great deal of the stormwater flowed east of Lexington Avenue. Lexington Avenue is north-south county road as it terminates in the northern end on Highway 13. And it topographically speaking, it's a rise that slopes to the east and west, cresting at roughly Lexington. A good deal of the high-density housing in Lilydale rests on the east of Lexington and north of Highway 13. These are high-density buildings for condominiums and apartments and townhomes. Which pretty much describes all of Lilydale, because we only have 5 houses in the whole city. The rest are all high-density occupied buildings. The water flow that discharged over the bluff, of course, has to flow around these buildings. And in periods of very high quantity rainfalls, 5-year events, 10-year events, those are extreme. It caused water to inflow into some of the buildings, into the garages, and at one time into the sanitary sewer system, which created an inflow and infiltration problem, and that's a whole other topic. But that was one of the consequences of heavy water flow. Other consequences of high water flow are damage to the bluff itself. the erosion backward from the edge, which means that the setbacks that existed when those buildings were built are slowly disappearing. Another one is the lack of directional control that we have over stormwater. It goes where it's the easiest to go, and that's downstream, both right, left, and north and south. So the only way to control that is to divert it somehow before it reaches those residential areas. Given the opportunity presented by MnDOT, Minnesota Department of Transportation, to install new storm sewers and river curbs and gutters along Highway 13, at least a portion of it, we asked our city engineers, Barr Engineering, to present us with some alternatives and cost estimates for upgrading the discharge of that stormwater in a means that would prevent some of these issues. They came back with five scenarios, all of which made sense, at least from a an engineering standpoint, not necessarily financially. We chose the one that made the most sense for the city of Lilydale and accomplished the most for the disposition of that stormwater. The one that we chose incorporated these steps. We would partner with MnDOT in the upsizing of the stormwater storm sewers along the north side of Highway 13 and agreed to share part of the cost with MnDOT for that. Another objective was that would have been accomplished by this plan that we chose was to decrease the stormwater flow to the east of Lexington and increase it to the west. The reason being that we already had an existing easement for stormwater discharge that we could easily use to build some structure, which turned out to be the drop shaft. In that area, and we had control over the size of it so that we could take the overflow of water from the east of Lexington and push it to the left and then down the hill in a responsible manner. And then the conveyancing system that we chose was the angled drop shaft, which starts roughly 100 feet back from the edge, bores at a 45 degree angle, and exits below, right above the Big Rivers Regional Trail, and then through a series of conduits underneath an already existing conduit under the Union Pacific Railroad and out into the Mississippi River. As part of this, and a very important part, we're charged not only with proper discharge of the water quantity-wise, but also quality-wise. And incorporated into the structure are four manholes, two of which are already built. The other two are to be built in the lower structure, which contain baffles, and the name of those baffles escaped me at the moment, but it's an engineering process that helps filter out pollutants from the stormwater, which carries phosphorus from the roads and people's yards and discharges it into the Mississippi River. So it actually has a enabling factor, a precipitate to filter some of that out, not all of it, but some of it. The total cost of the project is about $460,000. That's and by when I say the project, I'm restricting it to the drop shaft structure. The other parts of the bigger project have already been accomplished and paid for, and we did that by borrowing from our sanitary sewer fund and completely depleting our stormwater fund. So we're slowly building that back up, hopefully over time we will borrow the difference through a GO bond or something similar to replenish what we have already borrowed from the sanitary sewer fund. We're asking for $140,000 from the state to help in this project, and that's about all I have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Bullock. We are about out of time. So,
okay.
I do not see any questions from members. Madam Mayor or Representative Hansen, do you have some closing remarks?
I think, Mr. Chair, one and members of the committee, one thing to remember, if you've been to Lilydale, and Representative Erdahl asked me if Moose Country was in Lilydale, and I told him yes, it was, and then we left.
He's probably on his way to Moose Country.
He's on his way there. But I think Councillor Deal had mentioned that the average age in Lilydale is 61, and the average age in Minnesota is 31. And I bring that up for a point of, we have a lot of folks on fixed income. So Lilydale has stepped up and is paying for most of this project. We're asking for a relatively small portion. And these may not seem like big dollars, but if the city eats the whole cost that comes from essentially the changes that have occurred with the project that worked on the road, I think it would be prudent for the state to pick up a piece of this to help with the community. There's more people there than there were, but it is a lot of folks, a lot of seniors that are on fixed income that live in Lilydale.
Thank you, Representative Hansman. Thank you to Madam Mayor. Would you like to make a quick remark?
First of all, I want to thank Representative Hansen for having helped us along the way as we begin to discuss this project. And we hope that we've made our case so that you can see that this part of the city needs some help, and it would be a benefit to all of us who walk the trails, who look at the river, and who are concerned about clean water.
Thank you, Mayor Pampusch, and thank you to the other members of the council that were with us today. We need to move on, and thank you for bringing this project forward. Representative Hansen, you also have the next bill up today, House File 2577, for information. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and House File 2577 is another little ask for a little project in South St. Paul, and I have with me Superintendent of Schools, Dr. David Webb, to talk about this project, asking for $300,000 for demolishing an old school site in South St. Paul. So, Dr. Webb.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. I'm Dave Webb, the South St. Paul Schools Superintendent. Yeah, I have with me Aaron Bushberger also, and Glenn Bernstengel, our Finance Director and Maintenance Director as well. So thank you for the opportunity to be here today. Just a little context for our request. South St. Paul is the highest poverty community in Dakota County. We have about 50% of our students on free and reduced lunch in our schools. We also have the lowest local school levy and the highest school tax rate due to our low level of commercial and industrial property. So we're in somewhat of a financial box as a school district. Last year and this year, we've reduced our school budgets by about 2% each year. Good news is we have many of the same goals. We want to support our students and our community by collaborating together with the state, with the county, in a relatively new partnership, and also with the city to maximize our resources for all of our residents. We have also shared legislative priorities. We all care about educating our earliest learners and getting them off to a good start. We purchased the former Jefferson Elementary School site as we were out of space as a school district. And because South St. Paul, if you've been through the streets of South St. Paul, we're a landlocked community. There's very few open, vacant lots available in South St. Paul. And we're really looking for that viable next early learning educational site. So we purchased the property, and we actually own the park right next to the Jefferson School site. So one potential option is to create that community hub. I mentioned the county partnership because the county has been working closely with us they've helped identify the high level of need in our community, and they want to help serve our residents in a more targeted fashion, as we're helping with many of the needs for education and early learning. We believe that they'll help us also partner with some of those additional basic resources to help support all of our residents, young and old. So Glenn has just been working recently to remove all the asbestos. We spent about $200,000 just to make sure that the site is primed and ready for demolition. And today we're here to ask for $300,000 in funding support that would help to cover those costs that we'd incur through demolition. So we'll quiet down for questions that you might have.
Thank you, Superintendent Webb. We have this handout before us that has a couple of pictures, one of the facade of the building, but the lower picture, could you explain for us, are you planning on tearing down all of the buildings that are part of that lower picture?
So in the lower picture, this one really long building is all Jefferson Elementary. It's if you walk into the building, it was built back in the 50s, so there was just one really long hallway and classrooms on either side in a real traditional form with a small kind of cafeteria and kind of a down lower basement type connected adjacent building. But it would be demolishing that whole entire site.
So thank you. And that includes the taller structure with what looks like a chimney?
Correct.
So all of that is going to be everything that looks like a building
everything
will be gone.
That's a building is demolished.
And what are your plans once demolition is complete?
Yeah, thank you. So we are most interested in addressing the literacy challenge that we have in South St. Paul. As a part of the World's Best Workforce plan that all school districts are following with the 5 key measurement points, we've seen, again, due to our poverty, the kindergarten readiness indicators in South St. Paul decrease for each of the last 3 years. We've gone from 40% a couple of years ago to then 32% to most recently 25% this school year for kindergarten readiness, and we need to get out front of that. The county is, we're working with Invergrove Heights, West St. Paul, and Burnsville, the 4 highest poverty communities in Dakota County, to try to make sure that we have a Birth to 8 initiative. We see this as a potential hub site to help serve, again, our youngest and oftentimes most elderly residents in our community.
Thank you. I do not see any member questions at this time. Representative Hanson, do you care to give us some closing remarks?
Mr. Chair, I thought you might be asking about the hockey rink on the site there, but that does appear in the ball field, but those are minimal costs to take down. So what Dr. Webb and folks are talking about here is we need to clear the property in order to build potentially a collaborative effort for early learning. And the need is certainly there. You heard that the school district has already invested money on asbestos removal. This is similar to Lilydale in that the local government is putting the money in, but we need a little bit more help. And I think there is precedent when we looked at this for some types of demolition, and then it would be the responsibility for the community and the school district to build something new. So,
thank you. Just one more quick question. When was this facility last used as a school?
Great question. So 4 superintendents ago, Superintendent Dave Metzen, brother of Jim Metzen, here last served as superintendent when it was closed over 25 years ago. And fortunately, he wrote a clause into the contract upon the sale that if the Miracle Church that ran it for the last 25 years, if they ever sold it, we would have first right of refusal. So we were able to purchase it back just a year ago. And now, like I said, we spent the last year prepping it for asbestos removals. So.
Very good. Thank you. Thanks for your presentation today.
Thank you.
Have a great afternoon.
Thank you.
We have one more bill to hear about this afternoon. Representative Lagunias, House File 2443.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for hearing. 2443.
You bet. Welcome to the testifiers table, Representative McGinnis.
I am a member of LCCMR, along with our chair, and LCCMR is a group of legislators and citizens who make recommendations on how to spend the proceeds from the interest on the trust fund that gets its money from the lottery. One of the spending proposals that came before LCCMR this last year was from Lincoln Pipestone Waterworks. They wanted money to buy some land to protect their drinking water wells. And by consensus, LCCMR is recommending $1.5 million to Lincoln Pipestone. They'll be able to buy about 200 acres. That bill is now in process. It's been through Ways and Means and is on the floor. Here's the problem. Lincoln Pipestone isn't the only community with a large need to protect its drinking water. In fact, the Minnesota Department of Health has identified that there are 1.2 million acres of land in this state that needs some sort of protection to protect drinking water wells. Of that, 350,000 acres, more than that, are considered in areas that because of their geology, the wells are vulnerable or very vulnerable. The Department of Health reports to us that of that 350,000 acres, only 2,000 have been permanently protected. So what the bill I have before you does is provide financial help to drinking water operators and their communities to protect their drinking water wells. And I'm going to tell you a little bit more about Lincoln Pipestone because it's a very good example, and then I'll tell you a little bit about my bill. Because basically what the bill does is expand what we are potentially going to do for Lincoln Pipestone. It's a matter of equity, and one of the things that LCCMR discussed is normally LCCMR doesn't do this kind of project, and one of the issues was equity. How fair is it to help Lincoln Pipestone, and what about all the other communities in the state that have the same need? So basically, Lincoln Pipestone said it serves 10 counties, 38 cities. And as much as we've talked about the Lincoln Pipestone coming from South Dakota, 60% of its water actually comes from local wells. The soil in this area where we are, LCCMR is proposing the grant, is sandy. The water table is very high. It's susceptible to drought. It's interconnected with Adrian, and a lot of people have heard about the problems in Adrian. They have 5,700 acres in a wellhead protection plan. And they found that conservation will help, but it won't solve the problem. And in Lincoln Pipestone right now, a lot of land is coming out of CRP, and folks there say treating water after it's been contaminated is just far more expensive than prevention. So for them, the only permanent solution was buying the land, and they said we're just going to put a cover on it, like make it for hunting grounds. LCCMR amended the proposal a bit and said, well, you can do other things with the land. You could actually even put a windmill on it as long as you're protecting the water, and as long as any of the profits from the windmill went back to buy more land that actually protected the water. So let me just go over my bill really quickly with you, because it's all about wellhead protection. The first section is $200 million for competitive grants. Money would go to the Department of Health to protect community water systems that are in areas that are very high or high or very high vulnerability to contamination. I talked about multiple benefits in Lincoln Pipestone. We have the multiple benefits language here. You could install wildlife habitat, a park, trail, wind, whatever, as long as you're protecting the groundwater and any profits go back to buying more land to protect the groundwater. There's a provision in here with state matching funds and using money like from Outdoor Heritage as a matching fund, because you can use that land, multiple benefits again, use that land for hunting. So in Section B, it's $10 million to the DNR to acquire land, same kind of thing, but this land would just be for wildlife management areas, but it would also protect groundwater. It's definitely for wellhead protection. And in areas that are high vulnerability or very high vulnerability. And that is the bill, and I'd be glad to take questions from members.
Representative Hausman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to give Representative Wiggins a chance to correct herself. You said $200 million. I think you meant $20
million. Yeah, I did. I did. Thank you. You can read faster than I can.
Yes. Well, now I have to start listening.
I thought about going and looking at all of your all's communities and how many of your communities have vulnerable areas. I think it's you would be surprised to find how many they are and how scattershot they are across the state. Maybe folks do want to go back and ask the Department of Health at some point, do I have wells that need protecting? Because there are a lot of them. Any other questions?
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wiginius. yes, the areas of high vulnerability and stuff, I'm assuming the Department of Health has made determinations on that. What are the parameters and approximately how many areas are we talking about throughout the state?
Representative Wiginius.
There's some folks from the Department of Health who could probably answer that question for you. The Department of Health will have maps, so if you have your municipal wells, if you have a concern, ask them for their maps. They're detailed and they will be very easy to understand. But for your question, which is more specific than I can deal with, if you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Yeah, hi, my name is Steve Robertson. I supervise the Source Water Protection Unit at the Minnesota Department of Health. And just your question was, Mr. Chair.
My question was, how do you determine and what is the scope of the problem, essentially? How many areas of vulnerability are there throughout the state?
Okay, there are roughly 960 community public water systems in the state of Minnesota, and of those, about 920 are based on used groundwater as a source of supply. And of those, about half of those are vulnerable to contamination. We have, in our work to date, we've completed source water protection or wellhead protection planning work for approximately 325 of those vulnerable systems.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And how is the vulnerability determined?
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative. We use a science-based process to look at the geology of the setting in which the wells are placed. So for that, we look at how deep the wells are, what the nature of the geologic materials between the aquifer that the wells pump from and the ground surface. So if those materials are coarse-grained in nature and readily transmit water from the ground surface down to the area where the wells are drawing the water, then that would be considered vulnerable. So it's the time period, or how rapidly water moves from the ground surface to the wells that determines the vulnerability.
Representative Uglem?
One final question, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So they're vulnerable, but obviously they're tested, and I'm assuming that even though many are vulnerable, they are still performing within accepted health standards?
Mr. Robinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, that's true. If there is a we sample these wells on a regular basis. All the community public water system wells are sampled on a regular basis. And if there is a condition in which there, the water quality is exceeding standards, then we take action to right. To require the system to either replace the well or to find a treatment process to deal with that contamination.
Okay. Thank you.
Let me follow up on
Representative
that
particular,
particular issue. So as wells now are now vulnerable and become contaminated, the cost of cleanup becomes enormous. So in Park Rapids, where the nitrates got about above 10 parts per million, each household had to pay $3,000 to have a new system put in. In Hastings, they put in a new system in, I think, 2008, and now we understand that they've got to do more because they've got too much contamination. And if you look at their wellhead protection area, I know that the Department of Ag has tested private wells within that area, and many of the private wells are coming up with more than 10 parts per million. So when you're looking at wellhead protection areas, there is kind of a double benefit. If you actually do the wellhead protection, you are benefiting not only the municipal well, but any of the private well owners who are in that area.
Thank you, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe this is a question for DNR or the Outdoor Heritage Council executive directors here. I want to focus on the DNR wildlife management areas. So I think since there's been discussion since the legacy amendment that there's been less acquisition of wildlife management areas. And I don't know if Mr. Rivers can talk about acquisition of WMAs through bonding, or if we've looked, if maybe a history on that, or if we've had the criteria for wildlife management areas of water quality protection, whether it's surface water or groundwater.
Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, Pat Rivers, Minnesota DNR. And we do have criteria in our kind of our priority setting toward water quality and restorable wetlands, but not necessarily the groundwater that we're discussing today. It's certainly something we can add to our priority system. In fact, we've done that with Wilmington Wells WMA in Nobles County, working to protect the groundwater there.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a follow-up, have we done an overlay of the wellhead protection areas and your priority list for WMA future acquisitions?
Mr. Rivers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, we have not. That's something very easy to do. I can work with the Department of Health to get that information into our system.
Very good.
Representative Hansen.
And then finally, Mr. Chair, Mr. Rivers, do you know what the governor's bonding request was for wildlife management area acquisition this year?
Mr. Rivers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I believe it was $10 million focused on wildlife management areas, aquatic management areas in the Pheasant Range or in the prairie section. Much of that land would be complementary to this landscape.
Representative Hansen, you're done. Thank you. I believe there are no other questions that I see. I would just caution all of us to remember that when we purchase land and take it out of production, there is an economic cost to the state of Minnesota, and that too should be part of our thoughts and how we approach these issues. There are other ways to protect water besides taking land out of production. With that, members, I believe we are done with our business for today. This meeting is adjourned.